1, 2, 3, 4.
Thanks for listening to this podcast produced by Diddy TV. Visit DiddyTV.com for more exclusive on-demand content or download the official Diddy TV app from your app store today. Welcome to Insights, folks, where today we're excited to welcome multi-Grammy-nominated band Hanson. They've just released their highly anticipated new album, Red, Green, Blue, and the Hanson brothers, Taylor, Isaac, and Zach, are with us this hour to chat about the album, which actually marks the band's milestone 30th anniversary. It's a unique and creative project featuring three separate albums in one, with one-third of the overall album written and produced by each brother, Taylor's Red, Isaac's Green, and Zach's Blue. We'll learn all about the inspiration and making of the albums, what the guys have been up to recently, and much more. So without further ado, please welcome to Insights with host Amy Wright, Hanson.
Is Tulsa where you guys sort of weathered COVID, and were you hanging out there? And
absolutely.
Yeah. Tulsa's home base. So we've
thankfully, I think we had the most mild experience as far as restrictions.
Yeah. So do you have lots of space? Do you have land and all that?
We do have a good amount of land. Yeah. Yeah. We definitely have some ponds and some woods. So we could go. Okay, somebody go out. That's what air feels like. There's nobody around. Natural social distancing is happening.
I've
been social distancing for years.
Exactly.
In the woods.
I love New York City. I loved living there when we did, and I enjoy it immensely when we, visit and do media and do shows and all those kind of things. But I was never more happy to not be living in New York City than the last 2 years.
Yeah. Oh. Isn't that the truth?
Yeah.
I mean, any space, and we're in the middle of the city, but we had just put in a small yard, and thank God we had even that space.
Yeah.
But there were multiple times when we said, we've got to get out of the city. I don't care where we go. Someone has a cabin we can rent somewhere. Yeah. I just want to get out of the city, and I want to have some space. I want to run around and not see anybody and just breathe air and all that kind of fun stuff.
Just get some elbow room.
Yeah, we're lucky that, we obviously have a fairly large family coming from seven, and then all of us have a bunch of kids. And so even when people were really trying to be distancing and sort of thoughtful a part of that, you never really were distancing from family.
Right.
And so there was always a fairly large social group of people that kind of, it's like, we were with each other yesterday. I'm not going to social distance from you today. Like, that doesn't make any sense. Right.
Yeah.
Maybe somebody I haven't seen, but we were at grandma's house or mom's house, yesterday. So we'll just keep seeing each other.
Well, yeah. And if somebody starts feeling under the weather, we won't hang out with them.
Yeah. That's it's very normal.
That's what I told Zach for 3 months. It was weird.
Yeah, exactly. I'm like, I feel fine. And he's like, no.
Do you, I told you I was sick for 3 months, right?
Yeah. Well, yeah. I guess I'm still sick, guys. I gotta go.
Well, I had COVID. I had all the vaccines and then I had a booster. And then I got COVID, so I've had it all done at this point.
Same here.
Yeah, same.
Wow.
Okay, so y'all grew up in Tulsa, big family. Yeah. When did you start playing music? And was that sort of a requirement in your family that everyone take an instrument?
Not a requirement. We started in sort of officially in 92, mm-hmm. so 30 years.
When Zach was six, he doesn't even remember starting.
We were singing before.
I was eight, by the way. Just kidding.
Yeah, there you go.
I know exactly your pain.
Yeah, and so it wasn't. I think a lot of that stuff wasn't really conscious. We used 92 as the point when we actually tried out to perform at an arts festival. And so that was the first time
we did our first proper show there.
Yeah. It's more than just 15 minutes of the songs.
Yeah.
We had. We got to prepare for a show. It's got to be a certain length.
We didn't have any professional musicians that really paid the bills in our immediate family. So it wasn't as much a tradition in that sense, but there was a lot of music around. And our mom chose to not go super career focused as a singer, but truly, totally could have. She just didn't really like the rat race she's an incredible singer. Didn't really like the process of kind of that culture that when she stepped into the classical world and wanted to have a big family. And so we were surrounded by singing. Surrounded by her.
Constantly singing.
And our dad being very creative as well, but kind of chose to be the accountant and kind of be the responsible dad, you know. But, you know, we grew up around, I think more than anything, we grew up around hearing just a general tone of, hey, if you work for it, and it's possible, and why not? So not that, hey, anything's possible, just, you know, sunshine and rainbows, but we're not, there wasn't a lot of, do you really want to do that? That sounds risky. That was not said very much. And so I think that we were lucky in the sense that we had, you know, a solid family and parents that were supportive of the possibility.
They were just supportive enough and not like stage parent wanting to be famous.
Yeah. It was not,
I was wondering about that. Were they the ones putting you together, or was it, hey, we want to do this and we're going to support you. So how did that happen?
They were definitely not putting us together, except for the fact that, you know, the birthing thing. They officially
that was
put
an
us
important
together.
Part of this, by the way.
You know, they were the
original social network.
Yeah, social networking. It's called bearing children
and audition.
But you know, as you know, I have five kids, and so you know that also what your parents are doing is sort of they're providing certain opportunities. They're thinking about things that, as a young person, you just don't think about how things work. And so that was the way that they were really, you know, taking us to the next level. Hey, do you guys want to do this? Well, yeah, we want to do that.
The other unique thing about, you know, really our, there was an excitement. I think they could feel an excitement once they saw people respond to us. Mm-hmm. And also we were excited. We were clear about it. I mean, I had a very vivid picture of just hearing Michael Jackson and hearing rock and roll and singing.
Oh, yeah.
And someone responds to you singing and all of a sudden you're like, wow, oh my gosh.
Yeah.
And so there's an energy. Yeah. There was definitely an energy that there was something special. There was something unique. And with us, it was just natural, but you could feel how all of a sudden people would turn and go, what is going on? How are you singing this? And you're writing songs. And so there was an energy that there was something special, but it wasn't, it was such an anomaly. No one, there's no path that you say, these are the five things you do that are guarantee of success. You just begin to figure it out.
When you were so young and your boys, of course, was there ever any pull towards sports or anything? Or did you just already know, hey, we're cooked and baked. We're in music. That's what we're doing.
Well, the only soccer team I ever played on, we won. We were the number one team in the league.
Okay.
It wasn't because of me. But they were.
He was on that
team. We were a really good team. I did get a soccer ball straight to the face.
Yeah.
That was really fun. We did. Soccer was the thing that I think all of us played in some capacity. Zach played a moment of T-ball, I think.
quite a bit of soccer.
Yeah, quite a bit of soccer. Yeah. And I think that was the only kind of organized sport that we ever really got into. Taylor loved getting red cards in soccer.
No, I did not love getting red cards. I just got a lot of red cards. Yeah.
His favorite color is red. I beg to differ.
Exactly. But you know, I think really quickly the passion for music and the ability to kind of memorize songs and harmonize and things of that nature, it just quickly became obvious that was something we were better at than sports.
I don't think it's even that. It's I mean, you got to remember we were signed about when I was 10. So right around there. And
that's pretty early.
We were going out to make our first album that time in California. Yeah. And so that's about the time when kids really start to, you know, do sort of competitive leagues and go from just sort of playing because it's fun to playing because you're good.
I mean, I was playing on the playground at 10. I mean, I had that going for me. So
yeah.
You already had a career in music.
Well, you kind of have to decide things. I think to some extent, those kind of challenges are baked into the music and the stories we write and our songs, even back to, you know, Umbop is really this song that talks about sort of, yeah, some of your relationships in this life and most of them won't last, right? Most of the things you're going to do won't have a lasting impact on who you are and who you want to be. And so you have to choose, you know, because in an Umbop, they're going to be gone. In Umbop, you know, things will change. C'est la vie. In a moment, in a blink of an eye, you'll be at the end of your life.
It also happens to be a really catchy chorus that we couldn't get out of our heads.
But I think what you see in us is though
I think to some people it may seem morbid, like, oh, you lost out on those things. You also gained so many other things that you kind of have to just sort of balance it out and say, okay, I did all these amazing things. I didn't do all these things. But yeah, music was the path.
So you were growing up in Tulsa. Were you ever aware of how many other great musicians also come from Tulsa?
Not early on.
It was so crazy. When I'm going down the rabbit hole, I thought, oh my God, there are just a million of them. And if I had interviewed you a couple of days from now, it would have been on Hanson Day, right?
Yeah, that's right.
May 6th, I have to say, is Hanson Day in Tulsa.
Yeah, Hanson Day in Tulsa.
I don't think we realized quite how much we're part of the legacy of music that's come out of specifically Tulsa until, you know, years after we started. And you want our good friend who sadly passed away a few years ago, Steve Ripley, took a real mad scientist, brilliant engineer and musician, also, you
know, guitar maker, and then also
band from the Tractors, and he was Leon Russell's engineer, and he was in Bob Dylan's band. Anyway, Steve's amazing. He was a real historian for Tulsa music, Oklahoma music. And one day I remember him saying, you guys have the Tulsa sound. I'm like, what's the Tulsa sound? And it is that fusion. You know, there's probably something to do with the place that it is in the country, the kind of community. It's, you know, a little bit of gospel, a little bit of blues, a little bit of twang, you know, that's kind of baked into the dirt, you know. And even though we came out of Motown and got, you know, really soul music and then into singer-songwriter and craftsmanship, like, we have little pieces of a lot of these tones that you hear, and from J.J. Cale to Leon Russell to you have the Gap Band. You have, you know, this, all these different sounds that do have some connective tissue. And maybe also just the bootstrap energy being in Oklahoma, you know, you got to figure it out. You got to fight for it a little bit.
The land run is still somehow embedded in all of us.
Yeah, people are kind of go-getter. You have to be. If you're going to be creative, you really have to sort of make it happen.
If you're out on the ranch, you need something to do, right?
So. Right. Yes. Yes. Exactly. Yeah.
Spend the time
entertain
being
yourself.
Yeah. Right.
Entertain yourself.
There's, and then, of course, there's, you know, huge amount of country, and unbelievable amount of country music.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
And were you guys writing your own music from the start, or were you getting help from that department? And because you were so young, I was wondering that.
The earliest stuff we were doing was mostly singing songs we had heard, you know, singing 50 songs. And quickly, Isaac and Taylor were writing. And you know, by the time we were really recording our first independent album in Oklahoma, we were already writing our songs. I think it became, I'm not sure why that was such an obvious, immediate thing.
Hey, I think it was just an inclination. You know? I think
creativity. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you just at some point you know, get, like, I remember vividly, our mom, you know, played piano, or at least in some capacity, you know, had piano lessons over the years. And so she had played piano, and then our dad had played a little bit of guitar as well. And so I remember at 9 years old, when I was in third grade, asking my mom how to play, you know, some chords. And she just said, well, here's C, here's F, here's G. And that's a key, you know, so you can write a song with these three chords. And then that day I wrote a song. It was a relatively forgettable song, but it all, you know, you got to start somewhere, right? You know, I remember, you know, it was very earnest and all these things, and, you know, whatever. But the song itself is not important. But what was important was that I for some reason or another immediately understood and go, oh, I can write melodies to where these chords are going back and forth. And some of that is just memorization. You've already heard other music, and so you go, oh, that's where that fits. That's where that fits. And I think also having heard, especially early rock and roll, which is very much three chords and the truth, or, you know, 12 bar blues style music, you know, more so than others. It really, I think, was a great foundation for where to start with writing songs. It wasn't so just completely out there. It wasn't like you were listening to Piano Man, you know, by Billy Joel, going, I got to learn how to do that in order to write songs. No.
It wasn't, unattainable. It was within your grasp. Yeah.
I think too, with songwriting, you know, if you're going to be a songwriter, it's going to be hanging there. You know, it's creativity. You know, whether you're good at it, whether it becomes well honed, that's the work and stuff. But I think, like singing,
you know, writing songs is just is ideas. You know, it's just ideas, it's thoughts, it's creative thoughts on, and that the structure is a musical story. I mean, you're using music to tell the story. Sometimes it's a very short story. Sometimes it's a very shallow story. Sometimes it's a really deep story. But you're living your life, and ideas are born. And the minute you identify a tool, like Isaac said, a piano or a guitar, you know, you all of a sudden somebody says, "I'm a guitarist." But those are just like different paintbrushes, you know, that you're grabbing to try and figure out how to interpret what it is you're thinking. And so being, you know, to me it was inevitable, because it's all of a sudden you're walking around and idea, you start humming an idea. So I mean, that's one of the amazing things about music, is that it is, even for people that aren't maybe technically gifted in singing, you know, particularly, or writing songs or becoming artists, music is very innate in all of us. I think it's just figuring out if you have that extra little, you know, push. So
when you all started in piano, and I know that play other instruments, obviously, but piano is such a great instrument to create music on. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I grew up playing the violin, and I wish I had that piano foundation, just because it's such a great instrument if you want to write music, I think.
It's literally a composer's instrument.
Yeah.
I mean, it's literally what, you know, they came out of all the, you know, what was it? It came out of Vienna, basically, I think.
Yeah. It's, you know. Well, you know, that's certainly an amazing
sausage.
Thing that...
Yeah, sausage.
piano. Yeah, we all played piano. All took classical piano for a period. Me the least, because I decided I didn't like counting, and so I had to quit
and become a drummer.
And then I took up a career of counting. You know,
God has a sense of humor.
Yes.
The universe is like, watch this.
Maybe it's more that you just were innately counting as a drummer. Maybe. You just didn't want to have to actually count. So,
well, I think what it actually is I'm incredibly controlling. And so when someone else said count, I said, no, I'll count when I feel like it. I'll start the song whenever I'm ready. You know?
It's ironic.
So how did your lives change when you put out that first album? It was so huge. It went viral. It went all over the world. Mm-hmm. So you went from... you know, kind of a local Tulsa thing to worldwide fame. How did that affect you, or did it?
The short answer version would be it was incredible, and it was exciting, and it was what we dreamed of doing, to see, you know, to have the potential to write a song and share it with fans. And we saw very quickly just the power of music to connect with people. I mean, you talk about this, you know, music is a universal language, but when all of a sudden you're in Indonesia and you're in, you know, the UK and you're all over the US and people are singing those song back to you. I mean, it floors you, you know?
I'm sure it didn't hurt that also the chorus of
it's literally
Umbop is
nobody's language.
A universal language.
Yeah. It's like Umbop is, you know,
it's the closest thing to baby.
Anyone can sing that, right?
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Although it's surprising how many people remember the rhythm in
the answer to world peace is Umbop.
Yes.
Everybody sing together.
So you're now you're famous, and you're in that sort of train, you're putting out new albums, etc. What was it like, the transition for you guys from sort of the golden age of the album to the digital age? Because that was, for a lot of musicians, that was really tough. It was a whole different ball of wax. But you guys are so young that it almost may have been kind of fun for you. I don't know. What was
that
like?
It is wild. Yeah, we came onto the scene at a time where we really got the very last breath of, like, you know, cassettes and things were still there. CDs were totally taking over. Just a little bit of vinyl. You know, we made our first album on 2-inch tape, you know, analog 2-inch tape. And, you know, there wasn't any Pro Tools or computers. You know, it was like when somebody wanted to use Pro Tools on an album, like computers on an album, they'd call in like a hunchback. He'd come in with like this, you know,
I brought the computer.
Yes.
With the Pro Tools.
No, Eeyore or someone.
It was definitely the anomaly. One thing that we had that was actually a sort of a blessing of that moment is we did have such a young audience, and we were so young that we adapted, I think, more than most bands could, because we were coming of age. And, you know, so that audience, I mean, we have a consistent online fan club, a website that has a members only section that has been active consistently since 2000.
Yeah.
Actually since 99, but you know, the form it's in exactly is was since 2000. So 20 plus years. And the internet also allowed us to make some decisions about when we ultimately, you know, we had a big corporate conglomerate that one label bought another label and we found ourselves in a situation that wasn't great. Mm-hmm. And said, hey, we want to leave and start our own label. Part of the connection with our audience online gave us the sense, the confidence mm-hmm. to say, you know what, we're going to build something different.
And also youthful energy, because while we did start really young, even when we ended up starting that label and kind of going
on our own,
we were still young. I mean, I was in my early 20s.
Yeah, I was 18.
Yeah. So it's like we were still, in some ways, when we started our independent label, it was almost like we were a new band, you know. It was almost like the beginning of the band you know now is probably more like 2003, 2004. It doesn't mean that the stuff before that wasn't us, but the kind of the trial by fire was certainly in that period.
Yeah.
Why did you start your own label? I mean, what was the impetus there?
Well, there were a lot of choices we could have made at that point in our career. But what we had seen was a great deal of instability, right? We had been signed to Mercury before the second album was released. It was merged with...
Actually, while we were making the second record even,
We were in a huge corporate merger and we released the second album with that label. And then by the third album, we were already seeing these signs that there was just more upheaval. And so when we were looking at the choice... We were now kind of working with entirely new team under the same record label name, right? But it wasn't the same label. And we said to ourselves, how do we create longevity for us? How do we create a place that we can grow into? I think that's a big theme in our choices as a band, is trying to say, what do things look like in a decade? What do things look like, 20, 30 years down the road? Because those are the kind of choices we want to make, because we know no matter what we do, it's our name. It's our face. Yeah. It's our story. And
everybody else could have another career, the manager, the label, the record exec. We can't. If we don't have some level of stability and control, we're going to be just thrown around with the tempest and the winds of, you know, said time on the sea of music, you know, and that's a real challenge. And like Zach said, I think the instability is the right word, because when you really look at it, we were basically signed to one record contract, but actually had three record labels that we had for each different record. So it was a real challenge for us.
Forming a label was highly risky. It was very, when we looked around to peers and other people we knew in the industry at the time, you know, they were like, really, you're going to do that? You're going to, you know, essentially pay to promote your own albums. But I think for us, it just seemed like, the great choice. I mean, everything about being a band is very independent. You're being very different. You're telling your stories. And so it just seemed kind of like a natural choice to take that risk too.
We made a documentary about the process, which began as just, hey, let's film the process of making our third album, show the music. And it ended up painting a picture of kind of the demise of that relationship and ultimately starting the label. And interestingly now, I mean, we did it then in 2003, 2004. That's when the project finished, and the documentary we took around in 2005 to all these colleges and did lectures about it and screened it at schools. And we were talking then about, hey, there's this moment, you know, there's this emerging internet and the independent music is different. You know, bands like Hanson being indie, you know, that means something has happened because we're, you know, a mainstream quote unquote band with. And so it's interesting now because, unfortunately, I think the innovation that could have showed up didn't, because people began to, you know, again, labels began to take over a lot of the new technology companies that have been born now, YouTube and Google and, you know, Apple Music.
Or become victim to it, either way.
But it was a lot of things we were also saying have occurred, which is so many bands now are structured more like the way we set up 3CG, was this idea of, you know, producing music at hopefully a more reasonable cost and managing that differently, and then connecting your business in a more, you know, cohesive way between your touring and your merch and your e-commerce, and ultimately working with labels as marketing partners and having less complete control from the label. But really, you know, it's just about, you just make decisions each chapter to say, okay, where are we? What makes sense? Like, do we have the courage to make the hard choices?
Well, and probably with maturity and a little bit of knowledge, you feel like you had a little more business control over your...
A little bit more, yeah.
Yeah, and creative control maybe and all that.
Yeah, we wouldn't have probably made that choice except for the manager we had at the time, who was, for all his many famously brash qualities, he was brave to say, hey, you can do something different. And I think with that kind of Oklahoma bootstraps kind of mentality combined with Alan Kovac, who was our manager at the time, and his kind of history with bands and careers, it made for a moment where doing something new really was the only choice. Doing something different really was the only way to go. And so, you know, the rest is a little bit history.
Well, and as an example, an affirmation of why it was a good choice to do that, especially at the time, we realized that, ironically, the label that we almost signed with before we started the label, that label ended up hiring the A&R guy that we were escaping from on our previous label about six months later.
Right. In the musical chairs of the musical.
Yeah.
And it was like, oh my God, we would have been stuck with that guy again.
Yeah.
That's validation. Yeah. Now, do you guys record other artists or is it mainly the labels mainly for you?
It's really, we have always intended to record other artists, but we've never released another band on 3CG. So it's really acted as a self-release vehicle.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, so much of what we've done too, you know, sort of feel like we've been guinea pigs in our own experiment of, well, what does an independent band need? Mm-hmm. And what's one of the things that's happened in our structure is more and more things have come in, you know, from our e-commerce or what we do with our fan club to the way we interact with, you know, the marketing side of things, the distribution side of the label. I mean, when we started the label, it was lots of distribution deals with different regions of the world. And now, I mean, we're set up with a partner where we're, you know, releasing the record simultaneously everywhere in the world. And so all these little things, we've definitely, Hansen has been, we've benefited from and also been kind of experimenting on ourselves. Yeah.
I think so. Too, what you see in us is that desire to build something. And what we tend to do when we find someone that we love or want to help is try and help them build their own ship. You know, their own place to create music and release their music. And instead of trying to be in the acquisition business of record labels, sort of, I own a piece of you and I own a piece of you, which can really serve people in the right relationship. But we've tended to be like, how can I help you build your own ship?
Well, and speaking of independent albums, you guys have a new one coming out, Red, Green, Blue.
Yeah.
And which is very exciting. And I was listening to the three singles that you released. I watched the videos. Everything was great. Who produced the album?
So we each produced five songs of the 15-song album, and the sort of collective tissue, the cohesive connection is Jim Scott, who's an amazing engineer, producer. I've worked with all kinds of
Red Hot Chili Peppers, Tom Petty, Jackson Brown,
to
name a few.
A few small artists, yes.
Yeah. And we also chose to bring in a friend, amazing artist producer named David Garza, who worked with Fiona Apple and Midland and his own career. And so it's sort of a lot of people, five people produced the record in their ways, right? It's sort of three parts.
Yeah.
So what do you think they brought to the album? You guys are so creative yourselves, but did they bring like another element to the music?
Well, I mean, they both brought essential elements. I mean, the record was broken into three pieces with each of us basically, you know, taking the helm with each five songs. And so, you know, you needed different collaborators to bring it all together. So Jim is the engineer, the recording engineer. I mean, he and his assistant, Ben, so there, you know, the actual recording, the quality of the actual recordings is all about him. And so we worked in his studio in California, which is incredible. All vintage gear, you know, more vintage gear than you can, you know,
shake a stick at, as they say.
And then really, David comes more. I mean, he is not technical and recording wise at all. But he's incredible. He's overqualified as a musician. He can just pick up any instrument. Yeah. And it's such a great ear. And really, in both their cases, these are people we've known for 20 years. And both of them, there was just such a sense of camaraderie and love between us. So that's both of them brought those key elements, which allowed them to be, you know, the collaborators on the record.
Well, for better or worse, I think as a trio, we're a hard band to produce because there are so many ideas. The space is very full with where we're going to go and what people want to do. And
plus we're not afraid to argue with each other.
Yeah. And so I think at times it can be hard to add that fourth element or that outside force. And this mm-hmm. was just a great opportunity where we knew we were kind of in the most positive sense, deconstructing Hanson, right? To say, this is, you know, Jim Scott, we've known Jim forever. Jim, we talked to Jim about producing our second album this time around. We've known him since then. We've always wanted to work with Jim and it just never worked out. He's done some amazing mixes for us. He worked on our String Theory album as a mixer. And when we said, okay, wow, there's going to be so much more room for another voice, we kind of all looked and said, what if we had a cohesive sound, someone who was going to be working on all three parts that kind of made it become more of an album, not just three different solo projects, but sort of helped know that there would be someone there kind of as a part of everything. And David, I think, was kind of the same yet different, where we spent so much time writing together. Even when it's small changes that people do, that they bring in their ideas to an arrangement or a chord change or maybe you should cut that pre-chorus.
Or a groove feel thing that completely alters how...
And
how
so David kind of became almost played. More like the co-writer, though he didn't write on every song. It was more like you're more of a band guy. Jim is more of this great vision, this great cohesive. He just knows when it's right. You kind of look over and Jim goes, yeah, you got it. You know,
And you know, you can trust him.
And so it was cool for me. I almost felt in a way like I Isaac and Taylor stepped out of the room, but they stepped back in as Jim and David, you know, getting sort of in a way similar kinds of feedback. You know, Taylor has a certain feel about the way he talks about songs that David kind of brings and Jim, his technical know-how and saying, oh, use that mic. You know, Isaac has sort of a technical brain. He engineers as well. And so in a way you had a similar process if you needed it, if you wanted it as much as you wanted it.
Mm-hmm. Was there a significance to the colors, red, green, and blue? And I know they're separate. They sort of represent each of you on a certain level, but was there anything representative together?
Two parts. One is that red, green, and blue are a color format that you can make every color from, right? And especially if you're a designer or you look at like, any LED light or LED TV, right? It's made up of red, green, blue, and white, right? And so we're like, oh, that's cool. You can make every color. But it happens that since very early in our childhood, when you're from seven kids, your parents start buying you things in colors. They're like, okay, you're the blue one. So, you know, where's my stuff? Oh, it's the blue stuff, right? And so Isaac has always been green and Taylor's always been red and I've always been blue. I think it strangely fits with the sound of the music and the personalities of the people.
Yeah.
Or at least there's these connections to it. But when we saw that kind of both of those things were true, both Hanson is red, green, blue. Everything we do is red, green, blue, and also red, green, and blue. It just seemed kind of fortuitous.
When I was a kid, we had these things called garanimals.
Okay. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And they were color coded. So, so you know, each kid had their own colored clothing. Mm-hmm. I love that, actually. Your parents needed to be able to tell you apart a little bit, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
So,
where does this shirt go? Where do these?
Yeah. Well, and when you're in the same room, you know, growing up bunk beds, you know, it's like.
Of course.
Mine.
Of course. Mine. You know what was yours if it was color coded, right?
Yeah. Exactly.
So we have three singles. Child at Heart, Write You a Song, and Don't Let Me Down. And so Child at Heart, who's taken that one?
So Child at Heart is the red single and from the tunes that I brought to the table. It was the first song we put out. You know, and essentially we just released it based on red, green, blue. We released RGB singles. So that kind of reaffirming this idea of the way it all comes together. Mm-hmm. But it was an interesting one to begin because it is... it's kind of a soft start for us. I mean, we've always written, there's always ballads, there's always mellow songs on albums, but we've never started an album release with with a ballad. I mean, we released Go as a single on the Walk album, which was kind of the first proper single, but still Great Divide set the tone for the record when it came out thematically. And so Child of Heart is, I mean, really very, very on the edge of ballad. It's very direct. It's very intimate. It's talking about having kind of keeping hope in mind, even as you begin to grow and you're looking at the world and you're feeling like there's two paths to take. I can start to become a cynic and start closing up and start closing down when the world keeps sort of beating you up, you know, with what happens in life.
Yeah, exactly.
Or you can, in trying to hold on to that openness that you have as a child, where you believe in the possibility, and it frames, you know, it frames
an innocence. Yeah.
Yeah. And right, it's not to say that it could be a child, just be childlike all the time, but that childlike heart, which is open and thinking about possibilities. So, it's a really, I'm really proud of the tune. I think it is one of those songs that very rarely do you get to start a song with the chorus. So when that song starts, like, here it is. And so that's always fun, because it gets right to the point.
I also like Child at Heart because stylistically it's definitely different than stuff we've done in the past. And I think that's true actually of all these singles in a lot of ways, which I think is cool, because the record itself is a unique, you know, project in a lot of aspects, a lot of ways. But I like the fact that it's got this kind of Brit rock, you know, songwriter thing.
Very straight
going
ahead.
On, very straight ahead. And those big electric guitars with an acoustic guitar that's like right up front. I love what that says, not only about us as a band, but also what it says about the record.
What about Write You a Song?
Write You a Song is the first single from the green portion of the record, and that's me. It's a very personal song. It was actually written directly because my daughter, in a very kind of late in the evening emotional moment, said, "Daddy, I don't have any songs. You never write me any songs." Aww. And I was like, "Well, honey, what about this song? And what about that? And what about—" She's like, "No, but it's not my song." And then it happened that a good friend of ours was coming through town on tour, and I had him come stay at my house, you know, as a stop off on his way out to California. And I said, "Hey, man, you know, since you got an extra day, why don't you just stay with us for an extra day? And hey, we could write a song, and maybe it'll end up on this new record. It'd be really fun. Let's do it. We've known each other for a long time. Let's do it." And so his name is Paul McDonald. He's a fantastic artist, songwriter, all that. And it, unbeknownst to him, my daughter and I, Odette, had this conversation. And he says to me the next morning, "Hey, what if we wrote a song about, you know, how songs are the kind of thing that stick with you, you know, and even when you're gone, you'll have this song I wrote for you. What if we write a song like that?" And he kind of had the beginnings of the chorus idea. And I was like, "Well, that's amazing. I mean, Odette and I had this conversation 2 days ago. This is exactly the right idea. This is perfect." And so we leaned into it. And by the end of the afternoon, you know, when he had to roll out for the evening, the song was, you know, about 75% done. Yeah. And so, then, you know, Odette was in the room half the time, you know, humming along to the song. So she knew it was for her. So it was very cool. And so it made sense that then she ends up in the music video, because it was just too darn easy and too literal that we couldn't avoid it. Uh-huh. You know,
I was wondering if that's why she was in the video.
I think what's cool about that song is we've experienced so many times that sensation, right, of seeing how songs become something bigger, right? You write it for yourself, mm-hmm. and then somewhere down the road you meet someone who goes, "That's my song. This is my song with my dad, or this is my song with my kids," right? And you go, "Wow, that's amazing how these stories that were so personal have become so personal to other people, you know, outside of my life experiences." And the song really kind of talks about how the song will go on, right? How it will go on. It'll be there for you when I'm not here. And it's cool to reflect on that, especially at this point in a career, that there is a legacy to music. And honestly, you don't always know what it's going to be for different people.
Well, songs are a little bit like children themselves.
Right, right.
They go on and they take on a life of their own, right?
They do.
Absolutely.
Well, so Don't Let Me Down. So let's talk about that.
Don't Let Me Down is an interesting one, because it's the last song that I wrote for the blue portion of the album. But the blue portion was recorded first. And so as I was sitting, four songs done, And I'd been sort of challenged by David. He said, man, I love Bad, which is one of the songs that I recognize. Man, I wish you had something like that, that was just taking this feeling that I love so much and doing it even more. And I was sitting, you know, 2 a.m, sort of in my hotel room in California. And it was almost like an anthem for the whole process, right? As each one of us were taking on a solo project in our own ways, at our own speed, writing in these styles that were very representative of us telling our stories. Like, I was sitting this feeling at 2 a.m. before recording my last song, and I go, like, the moment is now. Don't let me down. Like, don't leave anything to question. It's you know, we have so much confidence and experience that sometimes you forget, like, how many things you've been through, and you still have to tell yourself, like, hey, I'm capable of this. I'm so proud of what we're doing. Now give it all away. And so that's sort of what the song became. And, you know, it's sort of this almost epic 80s rock anthem, right? And it was really special because it was done. I thought it was totally done. And then right after Christmas, a friend, Zach Myers, who's in the band Shinedown.
Outside of Memphis. He lives in Memphis.
He's a Memphis boy.
Yeah.
He sent me he FaceTimed me like 2 days after Christmas, and he had gotten a Peloton bike, and he's like, dude, how do I put these shoes on? How do I, like, because he knew I rode on the Peloton bike, and, you know, and then I'm talking to him and I'm just like, hey, I've got this song. Actually, you would be amazing with your guitar skills to add to this. And so he ended up adding his beautiful guitar licks to the song. And it just made it, I think, what it did for me was it put an icing on top of this beautiful cake. The song was about this process, but then the fact that the friendship, this sort of camaraderie of bands passing the night became a part of it, and the stylistic difference. I mean, we're a rock band, but, you know, they're sort of like a heavy rock band. You know, like, it's sort of like it's these different styles coming together. It just felt like it was the right message to be the first song people heard from the blue portion. And knowing there were going to be 3 singles, it's sort of the last thing people hear before they dive into the record, which seemed like just the right way to send people off.
Well, what an exciting time, you guys. And I know you're heading out on a world tour to support the album. I looked at all the places you're going to be going. I'm jealous, yeah, of course.
Lots of places.
And of course, post-COVID, it has to be a ton of fun to get back out on the road. I mean, are you guys excited for the tour?
Oh, very excited. Oh, yeah. I mean, all the musicians, you know, that are used to performing, I think we've all gone through a bit of withdrawals. And of course, as fans, I think fans are feeling the same way. So yeah, very excited. And, you know, not just to be across the US, but all over the world. So definitely looking forward to stretching those muscles, see if we can remember how to play live shows.
Yeah, we're cramming in like 47 shows in the US, not to mention a total of over 90 around the world. So it's a lot of touring in a 5-month period, but it's going to be a lot of fun.
Well, I think we've all gotten to see that it's so important to be together, right? For people to share experiences and, you know, all the things that are the same and all the things that are the different, you know, and one of the things that you see at a concert is like all these walks of life, all these age groups, right? Coming in and sharing a song, sharing an experience, a show, hopefully a great moment, and realizing that though we come from different places, different neighborhoods, different towns, different countries, right? We're very much the same in so many ways. And I think it's really to be a part of kind of going back out in the world and reconnecting people is a very special thing we don't take for granted.
Well, Isaac Taylor, Zach, it's been such a pleasure talking to you about the new album, Red, Green, Blue. It's amazing, and I'm sure your fans are going to be so excited to see you when you're out on this tour. So I wish you the best. Come see us in Memphis.
Absolutely. Well,
thank you so much.
Look forward to it.
Take care. Bye-bye.
All the thanks to Hanson for stopping by this hour to chat all about Red, Green, Blue, their latest record release produced by the band, along with Grammy Award-winning producer, engineer, and mixer Jim Scott, and Grammy Award-winning artist and producer David Garza. This new triple album of sorts amplifies the band's unique trifecta of sound. Hanson is a multi-platinum, three-time Grammy Award-nominated group that sold over 16 million albums and performed concerts to over 3 million fans. Founded in Tulsa, Oklahoma in 1992, this year marks their 30th anniversary, and we're happy we could catch up with them to help them celebrate their success. From all of us at Diddy TV, thanks again for tuning in today, and we hope to see you again real soon, right here on Insights.